ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Emma Pei-Yin is an Australian novelist who grew up in England and Hong Kong. But Emma's Hong Kong life wasn't so much about the high-octane, neon skyscraper Hong Kong. It was more about the family's ancestral village, tucked away in the New Territories, where Emma spent holidays with her grandparents, learning how to take care of the family cemetery and joining in on the Chinese festivals. And sometimes, from time to time, Emma's grandfather would tell her stories about his memories of the Second World War, when the Japanese military invaded and occupied Hong Kong. Emma eventually decided to come to Australia to make a life for herself as a writer. And whenever she wrote, Emma found herself drawn back to Hong Kong, to the hundreds of islands, the fishing villages on stilts, the mountains, the woodlands and beaches, that the tourists who think of Hong Kong as a city of neon lights, meat markets and free Wi-Fi don't really know about. And so her debut novel, When Sleeping Women Wake, takes us into those unknown parts and periods of Hong Kong history during the Japanese occupation. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Richard.
You were born in London, in England. What was family life like for you as a little kid growing up in England?
Life in the UK was really lovely when it came to my family. So I always had my grandparents who also lived in London. During school holidays, I'd always go back to see them, Christmas, Easter, all the school holidays. It was just me, my grandparents, just the three of us. When school was on, it was life with mum and dad. I think there was one place I lived in where we were only one of two Chinese families. And they also had the same surname as us. So everyone thought we were related. And we constantly had to tell people, no, we're not related. We don't know each other. But life was great growing up there. I had some wonderful friends. Yeah, it was easy.
You spent part of your childhood in Tunbridge Wells. People at Tunbridge Wells have quite a high opinion of themselves, don't they?
They sure do. I actually met someone who's also from Tunbridge Wells, and I said, I used to live in Tunbridge Wells. And she corrected me. She said, no, you used to live in Royal Tunbridge Wells. And so I was very conscious never to make that mistake again. So I try very hard to always say I'm from Royal Tunbridge Wells.
Please. Yeah. I mean, really.
Yeah. She was very, very serious about it. So, you know.
Okay. Royal Tunbridge Wells, it is. How were your parents with you when you were in England?
Very easygoing parents, which is kind of unheard of. You know, when I do talk to my other Chinese friends that grow up overseas, you hear stories how their parents are very strict. Mine really weren't. Growing up in the UK, I was allowed to go to sleepovers. I was allowed to have friends come over. I was allowed to have friends that were boys, you know, which is, again, unheard of. It was easy. It was going to school, going home, having dinner with mum and dad. On the weekends, they took me to Chinese school. It was like we had to drive 2 hours out. And I disappointed my parents a lot in that aspect because they paid so much money for me to attend this school and I just sat in the back playing on my Game Boy with my friend. So to this day, I can only really read and write your basic words like sky and big and fire.
So, how about speaking the language? Was Cantonese, was that the language in the home?
My parents, again, in the UK, they spoke English to me. My grandparents spoke Cantonese, so I used to call my grandma every night before bed unless I was living with her during school holidays. And so my Cantonese was learnt from my grandparents, who both have very strong Cantonese accents because Cantonese is also not their first language. Because my grandmother's Punti, which is the indigenous peoples of Hong Kong, so she has her ethnic language. And then my grandfather is Hakka, and so he grew up speaking Hakka.
Oh, and that's like a dialect, is it?
It is a dialect, right. Yeah. So when they spoke Cantonese, it was already quite accented, and then I learned Cantonese from them, which ended up sounding even worse, and most people didn't understand me.
How connected were you to your grandparents as a kid in England? Were they able to spend time with you in England?
Yeah, so because they lived in London, it was always easy to see them. I was so connected. My mum and dad, you know, they got married and they weren't ready to have children. I was very much unplanned. They tried everything, you know, not to have kids, and I came along. So they had to work 3 jobs each. we were so poor that we actually rented a basement of an older lady's house for 2 or 3 years. And because they had to work so much and my grandparents were retired, so I spent probably the first couple of years being raised by my grandma, to the point where my mum would come to me up to take me back home and I'd cry and kick her. I'd be like, I don't know who you are, woman. Get away.
What do you remember of your grandparents' home in England?
I remember everything. If I had to close my eyes right now, enter the front door, I can see absolutely everything. I can see the rug along the hallway. I can see where the telephone is on the stand. I can feel the texture of the staircase. And I know that the third step is the one that creaks. I remember everything, even the smells.
Yeah, the cooking smells?
The dried fish and the garlic. Yeah, that always got in my hair. And I'm glad I still had friends smelling like that.
Did they have a shrine in the house?
Yeah, they did. So it's in the living room. When you first walk in, it's on the left-hand side. And a lot of Chinese families do have that. So we had, oh my gosh, there were, my grandma had, I think, at least 10 different gods and the statues. But we mainly prayed to Buddha and gave offerings to Guanyin, so the goddess of mercy. And every morning we would light incense and just say a little prayer. I think one time I was trying to do it myself in the afternoon. I just thought, why not? I'll light an incense thing for Guanyin. And I dropped the incense onto my ankle and like burnt the carpet. And my grandma was so mad at me, but she understood I was trying to do something nice.
How would you spend those holiday days with your grandparents? What would they do with you?
My grandfather and I had a routine. So we were always like early risers. My grandma would sleep in a bit more. So first thing in the morning, we would sit by the kitchen table and he would have his breakfast and I would have mine. I usually had cereal. I had whatever I felt like. My grandma would get me anything. I was really spoiled with my grandparents. Even if I wanted a packet of like Monster Munch for breakfast, she would not say no. She'd be like, here you go. You know, you can have whatever you want. And then after breakfast, we packed up. Then by then, my grandma would come down and she always had lemon marmalade. So my grandfather and I would clean up the table and he would start to bring out all these beautiful, like, bound books, calligraphy books. And he'd bring out his calligraphy brushes and the ink and like a stone and mortary kind of thing where you pour the ink into. And he'd ask me to get the ink ready for him and he'd slowly write just for an hour. And I would sit there and just watch and smell the ink. And we didn't talk much, but I just sat there and just watched him. And that was like me and my grandpa time. Then he would go off and do Tai Chi in the living room, which I was really not that interested in. I tried, but it was kind of like, oh, this is a bit boring. Maybe when I'm retired. So then I'd spend the rest of the afternoon with my grandmother. So she'd start cooking dinner at 12 in the afternoon and we'd sit on the balcony. They live in council flats in London. So it's like very compact and we always had the front door open and people were always walking past and everyone knew everyone, like the neighbours. We had the Vietnamese family next door to us, the English family on the left-hand side. And even though my grandma couldn't speak English, like she communicated with all her neighbours so much, like sharing food and just she could say hello. So that was always really heartwarming.
When you used to go back to Hong Kong, make visits there, would they be there with you as well?
Yes. So early on, absolutely, especially because my parents were so busy doing the three jobs and just trying to get by. My grandparents quite early on would take me without my parents back to Hong Kong for Chinese New Year and the Mid-Autumn Festival.
And they take you back to their ancestral village. Which village is this?
So we have a village house in Tai Wo Village, which is in the New Territories.
So that's up to the north of Hong Kong, isn't it? That's near the border with Shenzhen, isn't that right?
It is, yeah. Quite close, yeah. So like after Tai Wo, there's like maybe two other places and then you're bordering China, yeah.
And this is, as I was saying in the beginning, this is the Hong Kong that tourists almost never visit. Can you paint me a picture of the village?
The first thing that hits you when you go into these villages is not so much the sight, but the smell. Because when you're in the CBD of Hong Kong, like the smell really hits you. It's like an amalgamation of absolutely everything. But when you go into these more rural areas, you start to smell the jasmine bushes. You start to smell the ponds. You can actually sometimes even smell the fish. Like it's more subtle in the way that everything smells. And even the way that the wind blows, it's softer. To me, it was heaven. It was calm.
What would you do there in the ancestral village with your grandparents?
eat. We ate a lot. My grandma, I never went hungry with my grandmother. So I was a bit of a chubby kid, actually.
Well, why wouldn't you be? With all that lovely food put in front of you.
Yeah, we ate a lot. So because the village was made up of a lot of my grandfather's family members, a lot of Hakka people were there. So my grandfather was the son of the third wife of his family. And so we have an entire row of houses where the firstborn son has the first house, the second son has the second house, and my grandfather and, you know, his children have the small third house. So we all would get together to have this meal, which in Cantonese is called pun choi, which is basically each family cooks this huge, extremely huge round table size metal pot of cabbages and meats, and it's all thrown in, tossed around with garlic and soy sauce. It's just amazing. And then you bring it to this anyone's house. One main house will be open for the night for dinner, and it kind of like rotates.
That sounds great.
It's like potluck every night.
You mentioned your grandfather was Hakka. They're really quite distinct people, aren't they? What can you tell me about the Hakka people of southern China?
Well, they are one of the earliest settlers into Hong Kong. And the Hakka people, in Cantonese, Hakka means Hat Yan, which means guest people, guest families. We make up like 80 million people today in the world, globally. So it's not like there's not many of us. There's actually a lot. The language, though, has almost completely died out, which is something I worry about with Cantonese. I do speak a lot about that with my Hong Kong friends. We do worry that Cantonese is now a dying language too.
Is it frowned upon in Beijing?
Well, even when I was living in Hong Kong, Mandarin was already kind of seeping into all the schools, at least the government schools. I don't know, we're quite passionate. We always try to sing when we speak because we know how Cantonese can sound quite harsh. We do say it's like Cantonese is more like the German like sounding words, and then Mandarin might sound softer. It's more like the French Italian kind of words. So when we speak Cantonese, we try to add sounds to the end. So we'll be like, oh, everything's fine, la, because we're just trying to soften everything that we're saying.
And your grandmother, you said her family heritage is from the indigenous people, the original inhabitants of the area?
Yeah, my grandmother is Bun Dai Yan, which is the Punti indigenous peoples of Hong Kong. Historically speaking, my grandmother and my grandfather shouldn't even really have ever gotten married, because if we look back even further into history, we had the Hakka Punti Wars, and those were like very popular, well-known clan wars back in the time where these two clans absolutely hated each other. And there was, I think, I honestly cannot remember how long, but there was a period of time where they actually fought one another. So the fact that my grandma married my grandpa, I find that really fascinating.
What kind of rituals or celebrations were you brought into with your grandfather while you were in that village?
The most important one was a tomb sweeping ritual. Usually in Chinese culture, we have like a dedicated day to do that, where families get together and you go to visit loved ones that have passed.
Like a day of the year or a day of the month?
Day of the year, specifically to go and clean the tombstone areas of family members, but usually it does last a couple of days. And it's a reason for families to get together, you know, because I think with the way everything's moved, we're quite separate nowadays. People move away. And so to still have these celebrations means a lot to certain families. So I had that with my grandpa. We actually had to trek through this huge hill to get to where our ancestral burial ground is in Daiwo. And so my grandfather and I, and we saw snakes too, which scared the hell out of me. And so I used to help him push this really long grass all to the side and start digging like a small path all the way up to the hill once a year, so that all the other family members on that particular day, we could all trek up there together and pay our respects. But once you get up there, it's like, it's again, very peaceful, and you've got a dedicated space where it's just massive stone urns of your loved ones.
Did you have the patience for that as a kid?
Not really. I mean, I definitely felt a sense of belonging doing these rituals with my grandfather that I definitely didn't feel growing up in the UK, because we didn't have such rituals like in the UK.
In Royal Tunbridge Wells.
Yes, in Royal Tunbridge Wells. No such rituals, no such royal rituals. But I think I was maybe just always focused more on just being in that moment with my grandma and grandpa, that I didn't always think further. Yeah, I didn't think much else.
Then when you were 14, your parents moved the family permanently back to Hong Kong. Why was that?
Well, my mum and dad are both born in Hong Kong, and then they moved to the UK when they were both very young. So my mum ended up in boarding school in the UK, and my dad also migrated there when my grandparents moved there. I think when you are born somewhere, as you get older, you always want to sort of find your roots again. At least that's, you know, what happened to my parents, and it's what's happening to me now. You always kind of want to go home. And I think for my dad, it was very important for him to go home, especially because he was working for a company that he kept getting pushed aside for promotions. And they always ended up getting the Royal Tunbridge Wells English person over my dad. And
some guy called Nigel or Tristan.
Yeah, or Chris, right. Or I don't know, any other name. But so my dad felt that he was working really hard, but towards no opportunities. And at that time, the cosmetics companies were quite up and coming. Packaging industry in China was really up and coming. So he decided to move us to Hong Kong and start a new life.
And when you say move back to Hong Kong, was that on Hong Kong Island or Kowloon or further out in towards the ancestral village?
We moved just back home into my grandparents' ancestral village for the first year or two before we then moved out of the home.
How did your parents change with you once you moved back to Hong Kong?
They changed overnight. It was so quick. It was, for me, it was whiplash. My parents were always really easygoing in the UK. If I said I was going out with friends, it was instant, no worries, no curfew even. But the minute we got to Hong Kong, everything changed for me.
How so?
Suddenly there were rules. Rules like no sleepovers, you're not allowed to have friends that are guys, you can't have friends that are boys coming over to the house either. So lots of new rules.
How did that affect you?
Not very well, because I think moving away from Royal Tunbridge Wells was already very traumatic for me because, you know, I was 14, and when you're 14, you think that this is it, this is your life. The friends that you have are the friends that you'll have forever. So I felt I was being torn away from absolutely everything I knew and I loved. And to kind of lose my parents as well, for them to change so much, I felt not only was I losing the UK as a home, I was now moving to this new place, but also losing my parents, the version of them that I knew.
Right, they were like imposter parents. Under the skin of your parents. It's a sci-fi plot almost.
I know, something happened and, yeah, things changed.
No, you can't go out. No, you can't have sleepovers. No boys. Well,
yeah.
Having not been quite English enough in England, did you feel a little bit not quite Chinese enough once you moved back to Hong Kong?
Oh my God, yes, absolutely. It was actually worse in Hong Kong. You know, the racism that I experienced in the UK is your typical racism that you actually, as a person of colour, expect. It's very sad, but you expect it and you deal with it, you handle it, you stand up for yourself. But what I experienced in Hong Kong was very different. It hit me differently. So I'd go into shops with my mum and I'd speak Cantonese, and I would have retail staff say to my mum, oh, look at your daughter. She's like a little white girl. And I think that really hit me because I was trying so hard not to be. I really was trying to embrace being a Hong Konger and being Chinese and being there. And so that hurt me differently.
How did they spot that in you?
It's the way it's the way that I spoke Cantonese.
Right.
Was just so bad. They're like, you're not from here, you know. So, yeah.
Would it have a touch of Cockney in it or something?
Probably.
Do what? How's your father? Right. So you're feeling the weirdness of these new strictures from your parents who are suddenly behaving very... Why do you think they did that? Why do you think they were like that? Is it the social expectations of the people around them?
I actually think it's because once we moved to Hong Kong, we were surrounded by family more often. And my mum, when it comes to her family, likes to make sure that she is doing the right thing, which in her mind is the very traditional thing, things that her brothers and sisters will look at her and think, you're a very good traditional Chinese mum. Well
right.
done.
And so, you've got this daughter who you've been bringing up in England. She needs to be licked into shape a bit, maybe?
I think so. So I do wonder if there was that kind of thing going on. But I also do try to think from a parent's point of view. I don't have children, but I try to think, what would I think if I had a teenager that was 14 and we're moving to a new country? I might have maybe some similar rules. I don't know. But I understand my mum's concern, especially around having sleepovers. Now that I'm older and I know more about the world and how scary it can be, I think I appreciate that more in her.
Nonetheless, you're feeling the burn of all this as a teenager. What was your plan for when you finished high school, Emma?
Run away.
Really?
Yeah.
Where were you going to run to, Emma?
I've got no idea. At that time, I had no idea. It didn't come to, you know, light for me until I was in year 11, year 12, when the school career counselor starts asking each student to come in and they ask you, so what do you want to do when you grow up?
And what did you say?
I always wanted to write. So I knew that I wanted to be in film, especially. I really wanted to be a screenwriter. And so I applied to the New York Film Academy. They had a campus back in the UK back then, and I was accepted. That was really exciting.
But you didn't have the money to go at that stage?
I didn't have the money to go. So after high school, after I graduated, I deferred for a year. I took a gap year where I taught. I was a teaching assistant for a while, and then I ended up being a kindergarten teacher, which pays fantastic, by the way, in Hong Kong. And so I was able to save quite a lot of money to go and study at the New York Film Academy.
Now, this is the hard thing to talk about, because something terrible happened to you while you were teaching. A fellow teacher sexually assaulted you and you ended up pregnant and you were only 17. You tried to keep that a secret for a while. How did your parents find out you were pregnant?
I collapsed at home. I completely blacked out one evening. So it was after I had taken a shower. I could have been the heat or whatever, but I collapsed and my mum found me in the bathroom. So she called an ambulance and we ended up in the hospital. And I remember when I sort of came to, I could see my mum and dad there. I could see the curtain being pulled back and a doctor coming in and just declaring very loudly, she's pregnant.
And what did your mum say when the doctor said that?
She came up to me very abruptly and almost, I could see in her eyes that she wanted to hit me, but I think, you know, we're out in public, so. And she just asked me a question and she said, was he white? I said no.
Did you tell her you'd been raped?
No.
Why not?
I think I was scared of her. I think, yeah, because my mum. And I want to just preface this by saying that I do love my mom and I know that she loves me. She used to believe that sexual assault is a huge dishonor. Like for a woman or a girl to be assaulted is to bring dishonor to your family and that it results in you being forever tainted.
You were still 17, so your parents had say in what was going to happen. What did they decide to do with the pregnancy?
Abortion immediately. I remember watching my mum sign some papers and then my parents left me in the hospital for 2 weeks.
With the way your mum had reacted, did this push you much further apart?
It definitely did. I think there were many times I wish I could have told her where, you know, I would walk down the stairs one evening and I'd see her sitting there watching TV and I thought, okay, I can sit next to her and tell her now. But I just never could, and I still don't really know why. But there was one particular evening that I overheard my parents talking, and they were very, my dad particularly, I could hear that they were very sad and upset about what had happened. And unfortunately, a few things were said from my parents that were along the lines of, well, at least she wasn't assaulted, because then at least our family honour remains intact. And so when I heard that, that was it. I never even thought I just told myself I would take this to the grave with me.
What did that do to your ideas about going to film school?
I didn't end up going. I think I went through a period of just, I just didn't know who I was. I mean, you don't really know who you are when you're 17. You think you do. But I think a lot of people, it's a coming of age. And so you're quite ready to go off to uni and find out who you are, explore the world. But because of what happened, I think I started to lose confidence in myself. So the person that I used to be in high school, which was actually very confident, I was the drama nerd, you know, always talking loud, laughing loud with friends, suddenly all of that changed and I became very quiet. And I decided that I wasn't strong enough or that I wasn't good enough to now go and pursue this career in film, because in film you've got to be very outgoing, in my opinion. So couldn't do it.
After this awful calamity hit you and you felt so alienated from your parents, what view did they then take of your future, given that you put aside going to film school in the big wide world?
I think they were just so disappointed in me that they lost vision too. So as much as I lost the vision for my future, they also couldn't quite see where I should be headed for. And so in the end, you know, we had some conversations where my mum and dad, my mum in particular, really didn't want me to get into film. She said that film is an industry that doesn't make for good quality people. And this is also based on her knowledge of, you know, the industry in Hong Kong back in the 90s, which was, you know, there were a lot of triad things involved with the film industry in Hong Kong. And so she does see it as this dangerous space. And because of what had happened, she didn't trust that I would handle myself well in such a space. And so we had a lot of deep conversations and they really didn't want me to go. And I felt really pressured as well not to.
What did they want you to do instead?
My dad always wanted me to get into business, one day sort of take over his business. He's very proud of what he does. It was just never in the books for me. I mean, he's in plastics and I'm against plastics. Like, I have my own water bottle, so I'm not sure how this is going to work out. Not sure I can help you there, Dad. So he wanted me to do something that was, in his mind, useful, even if it was going to study business or marketing or something. So I ended up studying public relations and marketing.
Despite everything you'd been through, I'm just trying to sort of put two and two together here, if that can be done. It seems to me like your childhood with your experience with your grandparents just gave you such a lovely feeling of security that when these terrible things happened to you, there was some really strong, irreducible core to you. Because I'm not talking to a marketing executive for a plastics company, am I? You are a writer. Do you think that's the case? Do you think you have this irreducible core that's carried you through all of this?
Yeah, and it's definitely my grandparents. If I didn't have their influence on me, I would not be the strong person that I am today. I carry my grandparents in my mind every day. They are, to this day, the last people I think about before I go to sleep. And that, honestly, there is something about my grandma. And if you met her, you would understand. Like, she just gives everyone the sense of hope. And, you know, you meet some people and you tell them, oh, I want to go out and I want to pursue this. And they're like, oh, okay. My grandma's not like that. You say you want to just eat a slice of pizza for dinner and she's just like so overjoyed. She's so happy for you. So I think I managed to get through it because their love was always with me.
How about courage? There's a fair bit of courage here too. Did you get that from them, or is that the thing that follows from that confidence and love and feeling of being sort of held in that kind of community?
I think courage comes after, because a lot of people I've met, when I tell them that I moved to Australia, like after Hong Kong, they always say how brave I was. But I did not feel brave at that time. I was very scared and I was running away from somewhere that I didn't want to be anymore.
But courage isn't feeling not scared. Courage is doing it anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Let's rewind. Yes, I have courage.
Okay, good. So you turned your thoughts to Australia. Why Australia?
This is a good one. So I wanted to go somewhere where I had no family, and I was, you know, when you're running away from something, you don't often run backwards. You try to run in a different direction. And I went to the Australian Immigration Centre in Hong Kong, and there were these posters lined up on the wall in these plastic slips, and I saw all the palm trees, all the kangaroos, and there was a brochure for Canberra that had palm trees on it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I'll get to Canberra, there'll be palm trees. There was even a beach in one of the photos.
Did you look at a map? Canberra's a fair ways inland. And I think the only palm tree is in the National Arboretum or something like that, isn't it?
Probably, even just as a photo, not the real thing.
And many people know I love Canberra. I had some wonderful years there. It doesn't have beaches and palm trees. So what happened when you got to, so you got to Canberra and did you go, where are the palm trees and where are the beaches?
Yeah, well, okay, I landed in Sydney first, mm-hmm. okay.
Oh, that's, okay, yes.
So I saw the tall buildings right. and I was like, okay. Yeah. Then I got onto a Murray's bus and literally, like, as the bus is, like, going, just driving along into Canberra, I watched as these buildings got smaller and smaller and smaller and then it was suddenly just grassland and sheep and I'm like, okay. And then we got into Canberra and then I remember my first night, I went to CIT campus in Bruce, signed in everything, I got my bedroom, I made a couple of friends and they said, Emma, I'm going to take you out to the city tonight. We're going to have drinks. And I was like, oh, sounds fantastic. And we get to the city and the tallest building is like 5 levels. Yes. And I thought, what the hell have I done? Where am I?
That's the Department of Veterans Affairs right there or something. Wow.
And no palm trees.
No palm trees, no beaches, nonetheless.
Yeah.
What were you doing in Canberra? What kind of a life were you making for yourself there?
I didn't know at the time what kind of life I was making. I was just going with the flow, to be honest, especially after what happened. I wasn't thinking too much.
So what did you do in pursuit of becoming your dream of becoming a writer?
Well, when I first came to Australia, I was on a student visa. So you're limited to work, by the way. Like it was like you could only do 20 hours a week. So I worked at a bar. I studied public relations and marketing. I did all of that for 2.5 years. When I finished that, I then jumped onto a tourist visa, which is then job hopping for a while. I just was jumping from visa to visa just to avoid going back to Hong Kong.
Were you building a happy life for yourself?
No. I mean, if I look at my life now in Canberra over the last 5 years, it's the best it's ever been. I'm healthy. My relationships are healthy. I've got a beautiful partner and a beautiful dog. But the lead up to that was not so great. You know, I have ended up in some dangerous relationships and situations with men. That is quite scary. But I've learned a lot from that too.
So you started writing. What were you writing about?
Feelings. Like every writer does, there's always feelings. I mean, I started writing when I was really young, when my mum first got me a Mulan diary from a Disney store back in Royal Tunbridge Wells. And it had a cute little lock on it as well. It was a plastic lock. And I used to think, my mum will never be able to get into this. Anyone could. And the writing kind of grew over time. But the writing that I did here in Australia in the earlier years was a young adult manuscript that was very much based on my life experiences living in Hong Kong as a teenager.
Were you keeping in touch with your parents while you were living in Australia?
No. So for the first 2 years, my dad and I emailed each other here and there. My mum refused to talk to me for 2 years. It took them 8 years before they finally came to Australia to visit me. But I had seen them a couple of times when I went back to Hong Kong for a holiday.
Writing for yourself led you to this idea of an historical novel, your debut novel, When Sleeping Women Wake. Where does that phrase come from, When Sleeping Women Wake?
Well, it's a very old proverb. It's, well, we don't actually know where it originates from because some people say it's a very old South African proverb, while others say it's a Chinese one. The meaning is the same behind it, which is when sleeping women wake, mountains move. And I didn't know that this was the title of my book until I wrote the last page, the last line, and it hit me. And I was just thinking, this is it, this is the title. And it really embodies the three female characters so beautifully. It just couldn't have been any other title.
The book was inspired by some of the stories you heard from your grandfather about the Japanese occupation of Hong Kong during the Second World War. Now, I think there was an expectation in the colony that Britain would somehow send the Royal Navy down to protect them against the invading Japanese, but Britain was fighting for its life against Nazi Germany and just couldn't possibly do it under the time. Nonetheless, when Britain surrendered Hong Kong, did the Hong Kongers feel abandoned by the British at that stage?
Absolutely. And this is something my grandfather spoke very passionately about too. He always used to say the British like only fought for us for 2 weeks. They couldn't even make it to 3 weeks. They did. A lot of Chinese people felt abandoned. But that also comes with its own history and discrimination behind it, because at that time, Hong Kong was occupied by Britain. And there was this sense of, okay, Britain is here occupying us to make Hong Kong better, yet we are not allowed to walk certain streets the same. We're not allowed to go into certain restaurants like the British can. We can't go into certain areas or parks. So that sort of restriction on the peoples is also confusing, because you are thinking someone's here to help, yet they are discriminating at the same time. So that would have been really confusing.
I remember like stories from my wife's family in Singapore. They always grew up believing the British were the best at everything, and therefore they would come to their rescue. They'd find a way to do it because they were somehow enormously superior. Mm. And when the shattering truth was revealed that the British weren't going to be able to repel the Japanese military, it was such a profound psychic shock. Was it a similar thing, the psychic shock of realising that the great British Empire had feet of clay?
Absolutely. And I mean, I have a character in my book, Wei, the husband, who is, he represents a small group of Chinese people in the way that they thought back then, which was, he was adamant, like to his gut, he truly believed the British were powerful enough to protect Hong Kong from Japan. And they weren't, and they were let down. But there are people, even today, when we're looking at what's happening, still there is this small hope that someone's going to come and help again.
What happened to the British and Australians who were left behind in Hong Kong when the Japanese arrived?
For the ones that could not escape, they were interned in camps. So there were three main internment camps in Hong Kong. So Stanley Camp was the main one.
That's on Hong Kong Island, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right down the bottom, yeah.
Yeah, so more of a coastal sort of area. And they suffered greatly. They suffered a lot. And you can actually read a lot of their family stories as well on this website called Guelo.com. Which translates to whiteguy.com. Yeah. But people have posted photos of their time there. They've posted what daily life also looked like in these camps. It's really interesting.
Many of the Japanese considered the Chinese to be subhuman. What did that mean for the Chinese people, the vast majority of the population left that were in Hong Kong at the time of the occupation?
They saw my people as animals. And I think that's why we didn't end up in the camps, because they saw the Australian people, the Canadians and the Americans as more human and people that we will put into camps and have some, at least some form of medical aid if they needed. But with the Chinese people, they were left out to rot. They were left out to die. They were, a whole shipment of them were also sent into China, because after the first year of the occupation, they realised there were too many people, too many Chinese civilians left over, and it was too hard to manage. So threw them onto the ships, sent them to China. So they saw us as very less than. There were ration cards. There were also jobs, labour jobs, that the Japanese recruited Chinese civilians to do. One notable one, which is also featured in this book, is a factory where Chinese civilians were forced to help make and also sew the Japanese soldiers' uniforms. They were not treated well. I mean, they could barely find a potato to eat most of the time. And so for some families, that meant having to try really hard to grow certain beans in your garden if you could. But they starved the people.
How did the Japanese forces use sexual violence as a weapon of war in Hong Kong?
You know, it is such a disgusting thing to do. I mean, you look at what's happening today and it's being used again. I read this book, The Rape of Nanking by Iris Chang, and she was explaining actually her thoughts as to why the Japanese might have used such extreme measures. And her thinking was that when Japan first invaded China in Manchuria, they won quite quickly. But then once they got into the Battle of Shanghai, it started to get a bit tougher. The Chinese fought really, really hard, and that battle lasted much longer than the Japanese had hoped. And so by the time they did manage to occupy Shanghai and start making their way to Nanking, Iris Chang explains how these soldiers were just so angry at the Chinese people.
It's a bizarre sort of revenge.
It became a revenge tactic. Right. So that by the time they went to Nanking, they started raping as many women and children as they could as revenge. And when I read that, I thought, what, like, how? How is this even a thing? And they did that in Hong Kong as well. And we have, there were many comfort stations in Hong Kong. One of them notably is Nam Koo Terrace, which is also featured in the novel. But I have to say as well, as a writer, I don't like to include sexual assault scenes in graphic detail. I think, you know, readers are intelligent. You do not need to write it in a way that is so explicit.
Resistance movement formed called the East River Resistance or the East River Column on the Chinese mainland. And this was a group made up of a lot of Hakka people, your grandfather's family Hakka. Where did the East River Resistance come from? What do you know about this?
So the East River Column Resistance formed actually in 1943. So originally when Japan invaded China, there were already several guerrilla groups that had formed individually to fight back. And so by 1943 in Hong Kong, the two largest guerrilla groups formed one huge group, and they ended up having different bases throughout Hong Kong in Sai Kung, in Tai Po. It's mainly made up at that time of not just men, it was women and children as well, and a lot of Hakka people.
What did your grandfather tell you about that? Did he have memories of this resistance force?
My grandfather was only 6 or 7 when this was all happening. So his memories, I'm very sure, are also based then on what he's seen, but then more stories that he was told from his brothers and his own father. I don't think that he would have seen as much as some of the other people would have.
There were stories of these little ghosts that were part of this resistance movement. Who were the little ghosts?
The little ghosts. In Cantonese, we call them siu guai, which means directly translates to little devils. And so in the resistance movement, they used children a lot because they were small and not easily noticeable. And these children were part of the resistance and they became messengers between allies and the resistance group. They also smuggled bombs in bags and ran through the countryside and rural areas to get from one point to another, and also medical aid from one camp to another because they were so small and because the Japanese soldiers probably saw them and thought, it's just a child walking, you know.
When the Japanese surrendered in August 1945, what happened to the East River Resistance? Where did they go?
What happened was Britain came back into the picture and they didn't acknowledge the efforts that were made by the resistance group due purely to their ties to the Communist Party of China. So a lot of these people that were part of the resistance ended up leaving Hong Kong. They had spent the 3 years and 8 months of the occupation fighting for their home, only to leave their home because once the British came back, they didn't feel like they belonged there.
Right, they were communists or communist affiliated, so they went to the mainland then?
They did. A lot of them actually ended up moving into China.
So you've been in Australia for quite some years now, Emma. Do you still visit Hong Kong? Are you still going back there?
So before COVID, I feel like that's everyone's travel story. Before COVID, I went back every year and I haven't been back since. I'm going this November to launch my book there, which I'm very excited about.
How much has it changed since your childhood?
This is a great question. When I did go back a couple of years ago, I think I already started to see the changes through TV commercials. When I was younger in Hong Kong, I'd watch TV commercials and it was all Cantonese or English. But then over in the last few years, the commercials are now in Mandarin, which I also don't speak and understand. So you're starting to see how that's kind of like bleeding over a little bit into media. So it is changing. You don't have to look very deep into it to see the change.
Hong Kong used to look very distinctly different from other Chinese cities, except maybe Shanghai. But is it looking much more like other Chinese cities these days?
I think it is. We are losing the neon lights, so a lot of neon lights have been taken down. And
see, that's unthinkable to me. I can't imagine that.
And I think that's why I'm in such a rush to go back, because I want to see it and soak it all in before the last light is taken down. But even the colonial buildings, I think a lot of them are being demolished and they are building high-rise buildings there instead.
What are you hoping to find when you go back?
Hope. I'm a very hopeful person despite everything. I think we all should be. The biggest thing for me is I just want to go back and sit in that courtyard at my family home under the lychee tree. I just want to sit there for a couple of hours and smell the jasmine and just maybe take a very long nap. And yeah, I would like to see everything I love about Hong Kong.
Where are your grandparents now? Are they in England or in Hong Kong?
They're in London. So my grandmother had lung cancer a couple of years ago, and she's doing quite well at the moment, but she's got a pacemaker and everything. And the doctor has now advised that she's not allowed to travel on planes, which is really sad because for her, the idea of living out the rest of her life away from Taiwo, away from Hong Kong, away from where our ancestral burial site is, I think it hurts her a lot. And I think she's trying to reconcile those feelings at the moment.
Will she be buried there?
Absolutely. She will definitely be buried there. But I think we all like to hope that we can pass quietly in a place that we find comfort in.
Have you reconnected with your parents after all these years?
I have, actually. My parents came to Australia for a holiday for Christmas, and when they told me they were coming for 3 months, I was just trying to find the nearest wall.
What? 3 months?
Right. I know. I was trying to find the nearest wall to hit my head against.
let's just start with a week.
Let's just do 5 hours, you know, like a lunch or something. 3 months, you know, at least we were not under the same roof. Like they stayed somewhere else, but I don't know. They're retired now, and suddenly I have whiplash again because they are not the same parents that I knew back in Hong Kong. They are so calm, so joyful, just every day is happy-go-lucky, and they need to stop giving me whiplash, you know?
But yeah, and, you know, quite frankly, you haven't turned out as a drug-taking girlfriend of a triad gangster. That hasn't happened. Well, not yet, anyway.
I'm still young. There's time.
That's right. Have you been able to tell your mum about what happened to you when you were 17?
I finally did during this visit. We were sitting on the couch, which I always pictured it would be on the couch, and it was. It was on the couch. And I told her. And I don't really know what I was expecting, but, I mean, I could see in her eyes that she truly could hear me and understand me. I think the empathy was still lacking a little bit. But what I have learned as well, I've learned a lot about my mum on this trip, about how she grew up. So I think we both now have this unspoken understanding of one another, where we have decided to put the past behind us and whatever time is left to just build something that we can remember fondly.
I think Australia is a Western country with Western values of individualism, and that price you pay for that sometimes is loneliness, lack of community. Chinese community you have in your ancestral villages has all that beautiful communal support, but then the price you pay for that is living with everyone's opinion of you.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a kind of a trade-off? What do you think about all that, Emma?
I think I'm so far removed from my family now that their opinions have to come through a text or an email, and I now have the choice whether to read it or not.
It's been completely amazing speaking with you, Emma. I so enjoyed this conversation with you.
Me too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Emma Payen's debut novel is called When Sleeping Women Wake. Today's conversation with Emma Payen was made in the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.